Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, Jose Nino. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program featuring contributors to the Barnes Review Revisionist History Magazine, a bi-monthly politically incorrect print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. For those interested, we are offering a free sample PDF of the March-April issue and a sample print issue of the Barnes Review. But if you want to fully subscribe to our magazine, visit our website, barnesreview.com. The website is your one-stop shop for revisionist history, which boasts a selection of over 400 revisionist history books. To take advantage of any of these offers, visit barnesreview.com, email sales@barnesreview.org, or call toll-free 1-877-773-9077, Monday to Thursday, 8 to 4 Eastern Time. To get your sample print issue of the Barnes Review, send a $5 postage to the Barnes Review at P.O. Box 550, White Plains, Maryland, 20695. Welcome, everyone. Jose Nino here, your host of the Barnes Review History Hour. Today, I have on former diplomat and now independent writer, Jim Jatras. How are you today, Jim?
I'm great, Jose. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic. So, yeah, I thought I'd bring you on to the show, Jim, because you have a wealth of experience when it comes to foreign affairs, especially with your focus on U.S.-Russia relations. Before we start talking about some of like the latest developments in the Russo-Ukrainian war, could you give our audience an overview of your body of work?
Well, yeah, I guess, first off, my body of work is now collected in a book called I Tried to Warn You that I published last year. It's a collection of my writings over the last five decades. So if you want my body of work, there it is. In terms of what I've done during all that time, my first real professional foray was at the diplomatic service as a U.S. Foreign Service officer stationed in Mexico, and then at the Office of Soviet Union Affairs, a couple other assignments. And after that, I worked for many years in the U.S. Senate as part of the Republican leadership, advising senators and staff on foreign policy issues primarily. And then I was an evil Washington lobbyist for several years with a lot of work in Eastern Europe, Russia, Ukraine, Moldova, Serbia, places like that. So, I would say I'm more of a, I don't know if I call myself an expert, but certainly got a lot of experience and knowledge, I hope, about American foreign policy as it relates to some of these countries.
Well, I would say, honestly, in this epoch where you have a lot of self-styled experts, quote unquote, that you stand miles above them.
Well, I don't know about that, but let me say one thing. I've noticed a lot of commentators, many of whom I agree with, are saying that the big problem with American policy is that they just don't understand Russia. They don't understand Russia, which is true, of course. But I don't think that's the biggest problem. I think that's something the Russians also fuss about themselves is, why don't they get it? Why don't they understand us? The problem isn't that. I think it's, unfortunately, it's been the quality of leadership in the Western countries, the United States, of course, but also the European countries that don't know their own countries, their own cultures, their own interests, and are frankly living in la-la land. They're living in an ideological pseudo-reality. So even if they understood Russia properly, they really don't know what the goals and interests they're pursuing ought to be as it relates to the real world. And that's now catching up with us, I think.
Yes. One thing I really enjoyed about your analysis is that it's able to synthesize sound geopolitical and foreign policy and research with the cultural facets of the U.S.'s global consumer imperium, because I've long argued that when you look at U.S. domestic policy, it's a package deal in the sense that it's very interconnected with U.S. foreign policy. It's social engineering that it embarks on at the domestic level. That's just extended at the foreign policy level. And when you don't understand that,
your analysis will always be at best like halfway there. Like, I agree with your point where you said that there is stuff that in many alternative media circles, they get a lot of the facts right and like the lead up to the conflicts, but they don't understand some of like underlying like philosophical dynamics that have created like the current situation we live in.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it'll give you a case in point. And by the way, Jose, I'm not going to mention a whole lot of names of people because I've mentioning people, who express certain thoughts. And why did you mention them? Why didn't you mention me? So I'm just going to say some people are saying, and people can find out who those are. But for example, a lot of people express confusion, say, why is the U.S. so hostile to Russia? Don't they realize it's not the Soviet Union anymore? Don't they realize it's not communist anymore? And they assume that all of this is just simply continued hostility from the first Cold War with the Soviet Union. And what they don't seem to understand is, oh, it's not that at all. Yeah, there's some regular lumpen Americanos out there who maybe have that, it's still, Putin's a commie, it's a KGB, Kremlin, hammer and sickle. That's not the problem. That's not the problem. I can tell you when I was back at the Soviet desk back in the 1980s during the Reagan administration, I had a reputation of being properly, I hope, of being a real hardcore anti-communist, which I was. I was never anti-Russian, though. And my hope always was that we would see the return of a Russia that was freed from communism, which at that time everybody thought was next to impossible. What's interesting, though, is virtually all the people I worked with, they were not particularly anti-communist or anti-Soviet. Quite the contrary, since they were essentially, godless, liberal, globalists themselves, they saw kind of a kinship with communism. Well, basically, people who share our values, they believe in a global vision, they're progressive, they're not bound by national concepts or religious concepts. And then when communism fell, that's when all of those people became very, very anti-Russian, much more anti-Russian than they ever were anti-communist. Mm. I mean, when was any Soviet leader demonized the way Vladimir Putin is? Do you see anybody demonizing Khrushchev or Brezhnev or even Stalin the way that Putin was? So I think people completely mistake the phenomenon that's going on with the anti-Russian imperative in American and Western policy.
You raised some interesting points about the anti-communist streaks in the U.S. because there has always been like a so-called kosher form of anti-communism that would be like tolerated throughout the Cold War that I think that mistakenly blamed like Russian culture for the rise of the Soviet Union. Because if you read Alexander Solzhenitsyn, especially some of his more forbidden works, he actually points out that the Soviet Union, in many respects, it was actually a very much an anti-Russian project. And there was a good book, I forget who it was by, that described it as like an affirmative action empire, mm-hmm. the Soviet Union, and that worked against the Russian ethnos in general and situationally used like the Russian language as like just like the standard, but had like a total disrespect for the underlying culture there. And what I've seen just from observing and reading Russian history and relations from afar is that there is like a very like residual Anglo-American divide and rule geopolitics at play where they just do not want to see a strong Russia that enters some type of rapprochement with the old continent. And then you couple that with a lot of the petty nationalisms that you see among some of the Baltic states, and you have like a recipe for continual conflict, whether it's with Imperial Russia, Soviet Union, or in the present Russian Federation iteration. And in my opinion, you have to also look in the mirror too, as you said before, that there is a cultural streak in the U.S. to pursue a universalistic foreign policy that wants to subsume the world in this like McDonald's type of vision for the entire planet. And when you have that and you have a country like Russia that has historically been a great power that wants to reassert itself in its historical domains, it's a recipe for conflict regardless of who's in power in the White House and whatnot.
Yeah, that's right. And there was that kind of messianism back during the old Cold War in what you called, kosher or acceptable anti-communism, which many people in the West were perfectly willing to understand as capitalism versus socialism. We're just arguing over which system of economy can produce a fuller lunch bucket. And I think it was late Sam Francis who said, yeah, well, that tells you the level of mentality of the idea of people who think that paradise is eating out of a bucket. So it's, yeah. So, and of course, you know, and so we did have with the fall of communism, that kind of messianism of not only corporate capitalism and corporatocracy, we might call it, over government, but also the increasingly, you know, the word's been worn out by now, but increasingly woke mentality in terms of ideology, this kind of marriage between rainbow ideology and corporatocracy that characterized the unipolar moment starting in 1991, when the United States, you know, in the words of Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan, wanted to establish benevolent global hegemony over the entire globe. Now, to any normal person, that's not only horrible to think about if it were to succeed, but any normal person now should be able to realize that isn't going to work. And we need to find a way out of the mess we've created for ourselves. And that's where we get now into the question of, you know, where's the Trump administration going? Are they, as so many people seem to be, in my mind, you know, taking a dose of hopium here, willing to accept that other powers, notably Russia and China, but others like India, Iran, maybe others, have spheres of influence of their own where the U.S. writ does not run? Or are we simply taking a step back in a kind of Leninist sense to avoid complete disaster in Ukraine and our loss of mastery over Europe while we reconsolidate and pursue great power competition against Russia and China primarily on a more rational basis? I tend toward the latter interpretation of what we're seeing, although, you know, I can't rule out that somebody has decided, well, I guess this isn't going to work. Let's actually look out for our national interests and not bother with other powers. I hope that's the case. I don't see that yet.
Now, this is a good segue into the topic of discussion, the Russo-Ukrainian war, because in my opinion, since the Maidan crisis of 2014, it has been one of, in my opinion, the watershed moments of international affairs over the last 40 years, because it was generally assumed, I'd even argue the Russo-Georgian War was also kind of like a strong deviation. But anyways, it's generally assumed after the Soviet Union fell that great power conflicts over the idea of borders changing is over. But that all fell by the wayside once Russia started asserting itself. But that did not happen in a vacuum. And one thing I really enjoyed about your research is that you look at a lot of diplomatic moves, defensive maneuvers, and other type of actions that the U.S. and its satrapies in NATO and the European Union made in the lead up to these conflicts that actually provoked Russia to take action. What would you argue were like the first steps that indicated that the U.S. was about to get into a really nasty form of security competition with Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union?
Well, you know, it's interesting. A lot of critics of American policy over the last 30 years, they talk about the Iraq War, they talk about maybe Libya and Syria and so forth. But a lot of people sort of gloss over the 1990s and the Balkans, for the, you know, the breakup of Yugoslavia, which, remember, was triggered initially, actually, by the Germans in 1991, and Germans and the Austrians in support of Croatia and Slovenia. But the United States, seeing that it was necessary to take control of the situation to maintain our mastery over Europe and make sure that the Europeans did not start settling their own security affairs without us, because after all, without the Soviet Union, maybe they would be tempted to do so. And they made, you know, squeaky noises that they might do that, just like they're doing now. But so the United States stepped in. And especially in the Bosnian War, and then later on with Kosovo. And look what happened there. We had, as you mentioned, changing borders. Well, we changed borders. We changed them by force. We even attempted, we claim to have attempted to have detached a part of Serbia's territory apart from it in the form of Kosovo. And then on top of that, we also lied about the legalities involved, not only about the war itself, but also the Security Council Resolution 1244 that ended the war and in black and white promised that Kosovo would remain an autonomous part of Serbia. Which, look at the timing here. When did we violate that Finally, in 2008, February 2008, when the United States, this is the Bush administration, rammed through a unilateral declaration of Kosovo from Serbia, and then all of our, we and all of our satellites recognized Kosovo as an independent state. The Russians did not. The Chinese did not. The Indians did not. So we already there. Let's see. We violated the territorial integrity of other states. We violated the UN prohibitions against the use of force except in self-defense or as authorized by the Security Council. And then we ripped up a Security Council resolution that provided for the future status of Kosovo. That happened in 2008, the same year that the United States and our NATO satellites, which is what they are, declared at the Bucharest summit that Ukraine and Georgia will become part of NATO. And of course, we've been expanding NATO ever since the mid-90s in violation of the promises made first to the Soviet Union and then to Russia. That's the context in which the Georgian War occurred in 2008 as well. I believe that was in August of 2008. So, you know, it was 2008 in some ways was the pivotal year when all the chickens came home to roost from all of our lies, all of our expansions, all of our shredding of every standard of international behavior as enshrined in the UN Charter. And then we turn around hypocritically and say, oh, you guys are violating the rules-based international order.
Oh, that term needs to completely be discarded from international relations lexicon. That's just like a rationalization for American hegemony.
Yeah, and basically, yeah, rules-based international orders is we make the rules, we violate them as well, but we expect you to abide by them, and we'll say when you violated even them when you've tried to observe them. So look, I mean, international relations is based on the principle of comity, not comedy, sometimes that too, but comity with a T, that the customary rules among sovereign actors are what is the rules of the road that everybody agrees to obey because it's in their mutual interest to obey the rules. But if one side shreds those rules and claims a unique privilege to disobey them when we feel like it, but demand that you will obey them, well, then I guess they're not really rules anymore, are they?
Indeed. Now, let's shift our gaze to Ukraine. What events do you believe pretty much made this conflict between Russia and the West over Ukraine inevitable?
Well, I think it goes back to the fact that, and this is something that I referred to in my piece on the Ron Paul Institute site back in December of this past year, just a couple of months ago, 3 months ago, that I think now has been vindicated by events, that there's been this effort in Russia to always come to some agreement with their Western partners, despite the manifest bad faith exhibited by those same Western partners. And again, it gets back to this question of, well, you know, what are we doing wrong? Why are we not getting through to them? We keep trying to engage them in a dialogue and they either won't engage or they lie to us. We just don't understand yet. They keep trying. And so we saw that, you know, certainly during the time, you know, in February, I think it was February 21st of 2014, during the Maidan coup, engineered by Victoria Nuland and people like that, when the Russians thought there was an agreement for a coalition of government and national unity that would lead to elections later that year, in which Yanukovych, the sitting president, would certainly be voted out. And guess what? Gosh, that agreement didn't even last overnight. And they simply seized power in the street after the agreement was reached. Did that teach the Russians a lesson? Evidently not, because the next thing is the Minsk agreement. And then they have the Minsk agreement. Okay, fine, we're having decentralization of Ukraine, autonomy in the Donbass. The government or regime instituted by the coup in Kiev will negotiate with the Donbass leaders. And well, that wasn't abided by either. And then we have people like Hollande and Merkel and others, Poroshenko, who is the subsequent president after the Maidan coup, all admitting that that was just a ruse. Now, the question is, coming back, and then, of course, the Russians, I think, as a kind of a last straw, I think they finally reached the point in December 2021, they put those two draft treaties with NATO and the United States forward and say, look, let's negotiate about these things. And I think at that time, the West decided, fine, we'll just stonewall those. They'll make some kind of a move, or they'll back down. Either way, we win. And if they go into Ukraine, then we'll just bleed them white and then have a regime change in Moscow, which is what their goal was. Things didn't quite work out that way. Yet we see nonetheless, you know, there's so many people, and again, I'm going to ruffle some feathers here. There are so many people who are saying, oh, if only that deal they initialed in Istanbul in April.
Yeah, Istanbul, yeah.
Oh, we could add peace 3 years ago, except Boris Johnson went there and scuttled. Oh, too bad. We could, how? That would have been another ruse. So the Russians had signed that deal. If they'd gone through, all that would have done is create, you know, it would have been the Minsk III back then. And if the Russians thought they could rely on that, then they were simply fooling themselves again. Now the question is, will they fool themselves yet again now that the Trump administration has been making kind of, you know, friendly noises in the direction that Marco Rubio said, well, we're now in a multipolar world. He actually said the word. Ruby also has admitted that this is not really a war between Ukraine and Russia. It's a proxy war between the United States and Russia, which is true. The question is, will the Russians now back down from what they said many, many times in recent weeks and months, that they will not accept a temporary ceasefire, but only accept a permanent settlement that guarantees their security? And then I have to ask the question, okay, exactly what would guarantee their security? A treaty, a Security Council resolution? We've seen what those are worth to the Western powers. So other than facts on the ground, I don't know what will guarantee their security.
For the listener's interest, the article Jim was talking about is titled, "Would a Trump-Putin Agreement Bring Peace to Ukraine or Just Set the Stage for More War?" It was published on the Ron Paul Institute, and I will have that in the show notes as well. Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed this article, and it's been one thing that has changed my perspective on the Russo-Ukrainian war, because it's very easy to say from your perch in a DC think tank, like in some like kind of like alternative, like more realist think that, oh, it's just a matter of engaging in hard diplomacy and signing some temporary ceasefire and agreement. But when you look at the history of the US's foreign policy behavior, as to paraphrase Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, they demonstrated that they are agreement incapable and they routinely break agreements. And in this hypothetical scenario where you reach like a temporary ceasefire or like a formal treaty, what's to say that this treaty will be broken like in 5 to 15 years, if not sooner?
Exactly. Exactly right. And that has been the pattern. Now, I don't rule out that the Russians, if they're hurting more than they appear to be, I mean, again, at least in a lot of the sources I listen to are convinced the Russians have a great military superiority right now, that the sanctions have not really hurt Russia and so forth. But let's suppose that's overstated. Let's suppose they're hurting more than it might appear, and that they've got the military advantage, but they're not that confident how far they could press it. I don't rule out that the Russians might also agree to some kind of a ceasefire or a phony deal, knowing that it's phony and that it's going to break down in the relatively near future, if they think they can gain more from that mutual deception than the other side will. I don't think that's likely the case, though. I think what it's more likely, as I indicated in that piece, is that what the United States is trying to do under the Trump administration is having, unlike the Biden administration, which seemed incapable of even seeing that, having realized that there's simply no way that militarily Ukraine, with all the help from the United States and Europe, can prevail in this war, and that trying to fight it until they get into a more advantageous position for negotiation simply isn't going to work. It's actually going to make their situation worse, that they're going to find some way to get Charlie Brown to try to kick that football again. We're going to offer them a peace settlement. We're going to offer them a deal, but it really only turned out to be a paper truce like we saw in Minsk. I think that's what they're going to try to do. I suppose the specter is there that maybe deep down they realize that that's not going to fly, that they need to come to some real meeting of the minds with the Russians on a security structure in Europe. I hope that's true. I'm guessing it's probably not, though. And the question is whether the Russians will fall for that again.
Do you see, let's paint another hypothetical scenario, that let's say Russia continues making gains and whatnot, and they make serious progress where they're able to incorporate additional parts of Ukraine or at least demilitarize it. And they just unilaterally declare their own ceasefire to just retool, reconstitute themselves, maybe owing to like domestic upheavals or changes in the economy. But they just do this anyways, like a ceasefire, without even consulting the West. They just do it on their own terms, and then they reassess the situation to see if they have to continue to relaunch this conflict a few years from now, or wait for like what the West tries to do. Do you see a potential unilateral ceasefire?
Look, one of the frustrations I have when I talk with people or do these programs, and people say, well, Jim, you see, on the one hand this, on one hand that, and this might happen, that might happen, so you don't really know what's going to happen, right? And my answer is, yeah, right. Like that great American philosopher Yogi Berra once said, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. I don't know what's going to happen. There are so many actors and there's so many factors to take into account. And sometimes people don't behave rationally. I suppose the Russians could do all sorts of things. The way I tend to look at it, if I were in their shoes, is that the only way to guarantee their security is to establish facts on the ground, present NATO and the West with a fait accompli, where the Ukrainian army simply, and the Ukrainian state, frankly, ceases to exist, and then they simply impose a settlement on the ground and say, these are the facts, you must learn to live with it. And then the diplomacy will catch up with it at some point and ratify whatever is established on the ground. If they do anything less than that, it seems to me, they're going to be relying on promises. And promises are something that they simply can't rely on. But, you know, one of the things I think indicates to me that they're looking for more promises rather than establishing facts on the ground for a military victory is that all of their behavior up till now has been what I regard as pedagogical. In other words, we'll do this, and then finally somebody will come to the table and talk sense to us. Oh, well, that didn't happen. Well, we'll do that now. Now do you learn? Now do you take us seriously? Will you come and talk to us? No? Gosh, we'll have to do something else. Oh, now we've done this. Now do you understand? Will you come to the table and talk? And they don't seem to get it, that nobody is ever going to do that. That, in words, they will never have what can be a reliable or rational deal put in front of them. And, you know, for example, why have they not destroyed, as I said in the piece, why have they not destroyed the bridges over the Dnieper? Why are they not destroying the command and control of the Ukrainian state and the Ukrainian army? Now, look, I'm not a military expert. Maybe there are good military reasons for doing that. But my guess is they're doing it because they don't want to win a direct military victory, or at least that would not be their preference. They would rather, you know, keep pounding away at the Ukrainians until at some point our side, which is the NATO side, the Ukrainian side, gets tired of taking a beating and finally comes to the table and sues for peace. Again, they would prefer an agreement, I think, in Moscow to a military victory. I think that's fundamentally a mistake from their point of view. And frankly, I think it's a mistake from the point of view of not only Ukraine, which is suffering this horrendous, obscene loss in human life, based on this meat grinder approach that the Russians are using. Plus, I think it keeps open the possibility of all sorts of, you know, false flags, especially from our British friends who are experts in this sort of thing, and the idea that the thing may escalate in a way that nobody anticipated.
Yeah, I am in large agreement with you, man, because the argument that some people put forward about, like, the Trump administration is like this realist administration that's going to reach a peace agreement with Russia fails to take into account that especially with Trump, but I'm saying the U.S. ruling class, is that they can't, as the younger generation say, take the L. Like, they won't admit, like, they won't take the loss and admit, like, defeat, and they're gonna try to, like, give Russia a poison chalice, if you will, in Ukraine. They're gonna make this victory hurt as much as possible and even open up further conflict or use, like, trickery. Because I'm hearing rumors too that with this guy, that one Jewish negotiator, Steve Witkoff, that they've been sending to Russia. He's been on a tour, like a diplomatic tour, the last month or so. is that I think they're also trying to engage in this geopolitical trickery of trying to do like the reverse Nixon strategy of trying to butter up Russia and to say, hey, we'll acknowledge some of your gains in Ukraine as long as you like A, either break your ties with China, B, break your ties with Iran, or C, all of the above. Like, we want to like you to like join our side, quote unquote, but really they're just doing like a divide and rule strategy. Have you seen any evidence of like them trying to go that route to create like a divide and rule between like the Eurasian like troika, if you will?
Yeah, I think so. If you look at Pete Hegseth's comments at the Munich Security Conference, and also that Marco Rubio interview he did with Megyn Kelly. Again, at the beginning of that, they said all the kind of soft and cuddly stuff about how we want to improve things with the Russians. But then you look at the latter part of both of those remarks, it was China, 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 China. And so I, and again, as I said in the piece in December, I think that's where they're going with this thing, that they want to prevent a total loss in Europe. Salvage something, come up with some kind of at least, cooling of the situation with the Russians, maybe establish some kind of a least, passable, normal relationship state to state between the United States and Russia while they shift their gaze elsewhere. I think initially to Iran and ultimately to China. I think that's what they're doing. I think they've made that pretty clear and their remarks so far. Now, there has been some, some things floated in the media. I don't know if they're true, that the United States is asking the Russians somehow to broker a negotiation between us and the Iranians, which sounds very strange to me. At the same time, we've got, it looks like it's just on a daily basis oscillating how high the threat level is against Iran. I think yesterday, Pezeshkian, the president, said something what did he say? He didn't tell us to go to hell, but it said something with hell in it about do your worst to us in terms of the sanctions we want to impose on them. So I don't know where that is going either, but I have to assume that China is the ultimate target. And they do think they can do a reverse Nixon, that they still have this kind of masters of the universe mentality that we're in control of the situation. We just have to flash the Russians to come hither, look, and promise to lift some sanctions, and they'll come running to us. And, I remember Vivek Ramaswamy said something like that last year during the campaign, is that, that's what we'll do with the Russians, and that's a deal they'll take. They'll break that off China because of their interest, and they're afraid of the Chinese. Again, I don't know how dumb the Russians are or how dumb they think the Russians are. The Russians and the Chinese are going to be neighbors for an awfully long time. And like forever, and they have a lot of complementarity in their interests. And back to back, if they don't step on each other's toes, I'm mixing my physical metaphors here, they're pretty invulnerable from the thalassocratic empire of the Euro-Atlantic empire. Why would they walk away from that just to please the United States? I don't see it.
I also think, too, there's a really strong degree of historical illiteracy among some of these people and wishful thinking, because this universalist American exceptionalist mindset just makes these people take leave of their senses. For example, the first Russia-China split during the Nixon era, it was actually preceded by the split of like the Sino-Soviet split.
Right.
That was preceded. There was already stuff in motion before Nixon came into the picture. And I also think, too, when you look at the internal situation of China, I forget who it was. I think it was like Lin Biao, who was very hawkish towards the U.S. His untimely death only accelerated Mao's overtures towards the West, because Lin Biao was gaining a lot of traction within the Chinese political class, and he was calling for a much stronger like anti-U.S. line, but then he was out of the picture. You have these factors. Like, it's a multitude of factors, and the problem is, as you said, the U.S. like thinks that it can just conjure up these agreements, and then like Russia will fall over. And there's reason to believe that there are people in the Russian political class that would fall for that. But I think in this stage where the U.S. has really just demonstrated so much recklessness abroad, I think it's making elites everywhere even uncomfortable. And I would even add to the Russo-Ukrainian like proxy war the U.S. is prosecuting. I think it will have a strong impact in how it forges alliances in the future, and especially when trying to contain China, because when they see that Ukraine was basically used as a battering ram, as a sacrificial lamb, to be honest, against Russia, it's going to make a lot of countries be very hesitant about entering certain types of pacts with the U.S. because they're just going to be bled dry while the U.S. Sits comfortably across the Pacific and Atlantic Ocean, free from the geopolitical struggles of the Eurasian landmass.
Yeah, that's right. And that's where, frankly, having corrupt elites in power in these various satellites is very important. I mean, you know, the British, the French, the Germans especially, have governments that are pursuing policies that almost seem to be designed against the interests of their own people on a number of fronts, including migration. And you know, you look at, for example, mentioning China, Taiwan. I mean, you've got the Kuomintang, which is the traditional nationalist party, you know, Chiang Kai-shek's party, that would like to pursue rapprochement with the mainland. But then you got the DPP, that seems to be the same kind of corrupt elites we put in power in other countries that are willing to, you know, turn their country into, of course, Taiwan's not a country, but turn the place they live into a hellhole, into a slaughterhouse, in order to please their masters in Washington. And the question is, you know, are the people in Taiwan dumb enough to fall for that? Frankly, I think they're probably a little smarter than the people in Ukraine have turned out to be. Although, let's be fair, Ukrainians, even without Crimea and without the Donbas, voted for Poroshenko in Ukraine after, let's see, what year would that have been? I guess 2014 or 15. Because he promised them peace. Of course, he was lying. And then in 2000, I guess it was 2000.
Fell for it.
He fell for it again with Zelensky. He promised them peace. And of course, he was lying too. So it's not like they chose this. I mean, it's not like the voters in Ukraine did not take whatever opportunity was offered to them for a peace candidate, but that's not what they got. You know, back to the China thing, you're right. I mean, the Sino-Soviet split between two communist parties was largely an ideological split, you know, especially after de-Stalinization in the Soviet Union, and also some rivalry for leadership in the World Communist Movement. That doesn't exist anymore. I mean,
no, yeah, it doesn't. No,
they're both. You know, a lot of people, you know, especially here, a lot of the you know, the Republican normies like to go China, 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 the same way the Dems like to go Russia, Russia, Russia. It's Chinese Communist Party. Oh, yeah, it's the Communist Party, but it's a communist bottle full of nationalist wine. And just like Russia emerged formally as a nationalist country with a strong Orthodox Christian ethos in its state system following the end of communism, China is not functionally a communist party. It's like a new Confucian Mandarin class that basically is a national government. And, you know, people say, yeah, but the Chinese might want to take Siberia from the Russians. Why would they want to do that? All the, you know, all those resources there, the Russians are perfectly happy to sell them. You know, even if the Chinese wanted to seize them, which militarily would be a very dangerous thing to try to do.
Yeah, nuclear deterrence, huh?
What would they gain by doing that? They'd still have to exploit all those resources themselves, and it would cost them a lot of money that the Russians are perfectly happy to sell them to them for reasonable prices. There's a natural complementarity there between Russian resources and Chinese industry. You know, the Chinese like, you know, Russian weapons. I mean, there's all sorts of pluses there for them on both sides. Why would they clash with each other, especially since they don't have an ideological problem between them?
Yes, some of these talking points, I read like Foreign Affairs and all those other journals. They have, it's almost like an indirect form of like a psyop to try to create this narrative to gaslight policymakers like in Russia and like concerned parties about this so-called like Chinese threat. But one other point, too, when you mentioned Taiwan, And this goes back to what we were talking about, how the domestic is tied to the international. I've been noticing in the last few years, there are other movements in Taiwan, which I believe are like fully AstroTurf, the NGO network, to claim that the Taiwanese, the indigenous Taiwanese, are like the victims of Han Chinese oppression and all this.
Right,
They've been cooking up a lot of those narratives. And it's funny you mentioned the Kuomintang, because history sure does have a cruel sense of irony, how like the Nationalist Party, which initially like separated from like the communist mainland, may actually be like the element that leads to a peaceful reunification of China and Taiwan.
Exactly right. And of course, what you say about the native Taiwanese, you know, you're right. That's sort of like trying to recreate in Taiwan what you have in Ukraine, which is this is a Ukrainian national movement. The Ukrainians are nothing like Russians, have nothing to do with Russians. Whereas, you know, if you look at it historically, they all came from Rus, the ancient Rus state, whether they're Russians now or Belarusians or Ukrainians. And fundamentally, they're not that different than, say, you know, in Germany, Saxons, Bavarians, and Prussians, or in Italy, you know, Sardinians, Sicilians, then Venetians, and so forth. When we talk about native Taiwanese, yeah, there are a small group of what they call aborigines, or basically Austronesian people related to the Polynesians, for example. They're only like, I think, 1 or 2% of the population. The so-called native Taiwanese are Han Chinese. They are Han Chinese. They've been there for hundreds of years and been the majority population there. And then they were joined, of course, by other mainland Chinese when the Nationalists lost the civil war against the communists in 1949. So they're all Chinese. They're all Han Chinese. They're just different waves of migration to the island from the mainland. That's all.
Indeed. Now, where are things going from what you've observed with Russia, like in terms of like the battlefield progress and potential negotiations?
The short answer is I don't know. I mean, you know, I see what's posted on the media. You try to triangulate and see how accurate any of it is. It looks like the Kursk adventure is coming to an end. You know, I don't know if that's something we're saying, oh, look, this shows how incompetent the Russians are. It took them this long to close down Kursk. Or you accept what's being said on the other side. No, the Russians could have closed that off at any time. But why do it when the Ukrainians keep throwing more men and machines in there to be destroyed? And now maybe they can finally cut them off and have a big pocket, you know, their own Dunkirk this time, but not let them escape. So I don't really know. I mean, it looks like Kursk one way or the other is going to end. Like I said, I don't really understand why the Russians are fighting the war the way they are doing, which seems more designed to kill off as many Ukrainian men as possible while opening the door to negotiations rather than actually winning the war in a way that would not only save Russian manpower, but probably a lot of Ukrainian lives too, if they simply took steps to make sure the Ukrainians could not continue the war. They don't seem to be eager to do that. I don't know why.
So, like, you would, in a more, like, rational course of, like, policy actions, do you think that that would kind of, like, entail the kind of, like, creation of, like, a kind of east, like, west Ukrainian split, or what would it look like in your view?
Well, I don't know. I mean, see, that's the thing. If I were in Moscow, I would say the only way we can be sure about our security from the side of Ukraine would be to take all of Ukraine except the far, far west, which, you know, basically they go to Poland, Romania, Slovakia, Hungary, whoever, let them fight over the scraps, essentially returning to the borders of 1939, or for that matter, the borders of 1914 with regard to the Austrian Empire. That it seemed to be, because remember, those are areas, we're not just talking about the east, you know, east of the Dnieper, we're talking about areas that had been part of the Russian Empire before 1914, and had, you know, frankly, all of those people, whether they spoke, quote, Ukrainian or spoke, quote, Russian, thought of themselves as Russians. It was really only the Soviet period where they cultivated this idea, no, Ukrainian is a separate nationality. Belarusian is a separate nationality. So, I think some people say, oh, no, they couldn't do that. They'd face Afghanistan, it would be a guerrilla war. I don't think it would be anything of the sort. As far as the far west goes, Yeah, I think the Russians are perfectly willing to shrug their shoulders and say, hey, the Poles, you want Lvov back? Feel free. And I think there's probably some people in Poland who would welcome that, although it means also they'd be fighting like spiders in a jar with the extreme West Ukrainian nationalists, the Banderists, who, as you know, massacred tens of thousands of Poles in 1943 in the Volnia region. So, you know, there are a lot of historic animosities there. Short of that, yeah, I could see a circumstance, again, if I were thinking from Moscow's point of view, where you say, okay, not only to take these four oblasts, you take everything east of the Dnieper, including Kharkov, Chernigov, all these areas, but also Kherson, Odessa, Nikolaev, and up to Pridnestrovia, to Transnistria in Moldova. And then you have some kind of basically a non-viable rump Ukrainian state that becomes kind of like a Ukrainian Belarus, basically a Russian puppet state. I could see that as a possible outcome if the Russians are looking out for their national interests. If they do anything less than that, in my opinion, I think they're just asking for trouble. They're asking for a continued tug of war between Eastern and Western influences in whatever kind of Ukraine is left, especially if they leave Odessa in whatever Ukrainian state is left. So that's why I think, for example, that Istanbul Agreement was a mirage in 2023, that the Russians were foolish to think if that would actually secure their interests. But again, I'm not in possession of all the facts. I can understand there could be countervailing considerations, but from what I can see, that's the way it looks to me.
I would also argue as well that even if NATO were to dissolve, I would not put it past the DC Anglo elites to like conjure up a Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth LARP or some like Hanseatic League type of LARP to like continue to balance against Russia. Because as we touched on before, there's a really long, well-established tradition of Anglo-Saxon and now like American divide and rule strategy, where they'll just try to always create some type of balancing coalition of countries against Russia to just prevent it from ever integrating with the rest of Europe in some shape or form. And that's why when I saw that Finland and Sweden were added to NATO, my initial impression wasn't so much like, oh, these are game changers, that because they obviously don't bring much to the table in terms of military. But I was thinking more long term, they're probably like setting the gears for some type of U.S. Anglo-led type of scheme to just focus more on like giving Russia fits like in the Baltic area and like the North Sea. Because at the end of the day, when people talk about European security, that continent is so vast and there's so many countries with different security priorities and the way they view threats. Like, it's just not like reasonable to assume that like a Spaniard is going to view Russia the same way as like an Estonian. So even like with like a so-called like no Ukraine in NATO guarantee, there's still room for subversion that the U.S. could like easily pivot to. And I've seen also, this isn't just me making hypothetical statements. I've seen statements from like think tanks like the Vandenberg Institute and other factions of the so-called foreign policy blob talk about this. And it's also in line with Donald Rumsfeld's New Europe strategy, where he extolled Eastern Europe while called out Western Europe for their unwillingness to confront Russia.
Well, you know, I think there even have been some like hints about that sort of thing from the Trump administration. You know, Trump has talked about possibly moving troops out of Germany, but maybe putting them in Romania. Or, and I don't know if the Poles are going to, you know, try to.
I've heard of the Poles.
Fort Trump nonsense in Poland. I can see what you're saying. And that certainly has been the Anglo-American game plan for a long time. In fact, some people would say that both world wars, as well as the Cold War and NATO, are essentially bids by the Anglo-Americans to make sure that there could be no rapprochement between Germany and Russia. Because if there is at that point, that Europe is out of our control. And so I think there's some possibility of that. But I would tend to look at it the other way around. You know, at the time of that Boris Johnson scuttled Istanbul, he said something to the effect that Russia must lose this war and be seen to lose this war. And I would tend to look at that the other way around from the Russian point of view, that NATO must lose this war and be seen to lose this war, because I think if the war were to end on a maximum note from what I described earlier from Moscow's point of view, I don't think NATO could survive that. And I don't think the resources or the political material, much less the economic and industrial bases there for the kind of, you know, new Lithuanian, Polish Commonwealth or Hanseatic League. I think quite to the contrary, at that point, you would see such a shock throughout Europe that I don't think NATO would survive. And maybe the EU, which is just NATO's concubine, I don't think it would survive that either. Mm. And I think you would see a lot of countries saying, you know what, this is really stupid. We have to look out for our own interests. And that means going back and patching things up with the Russians. So I could easily see a different kind of situation there where a lot of countries decide in Europe, you know what, we need to look out for Poland first, for Germany first, for France first. Let's be on good terms with the Russians. We all live on the same continent. You know, there was a great memorandum written to Nicholas II called the Dornova Memorandum in February of 1914, pointing out how Russia's policy was falling into the trap set by the British that were actually contrary to Russia's own interests, which lay in a rapprochement with Germany and also with France. And that would be a combination that would be absolutely impregnable from the outside. I think that's where the future lies if people start looking out for their own interests. The question is, do they ever get nationally minded governments, like, you know, if we can dream the AfD coming to power in Germany, or do we could just keep having these, you know, I can't even think of a word that's printable for people like Macron and Starmer.
Yeah, total empty suits. Yes, there is just a lack of leadership in general. And that's one thing I like about your analysis of Jim, is that you point out that it's a ruling class issue, that you just don't have like leaders that are competent or farsighted enough to pursue more rational policies. And when we have that same type of set that's in power, conflict is only inevitable.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you know, I don't know how much of it is incompetent or how much is because, you know, we're talking about people whose moral and spiritual center of gravity is so just wrong. You know, they're the kind of people who think like, you know, Klaus Schwab and the Wabos and all that. I mean, their whole idea of human life is contrary to just the fundamental basis of not only of religion, but of family and marriage and normal, you know, human interests, human benefits, that they just live in a completely different kind of anti-world when it comes to morality.
Indeed. Well, I think this is a great spot to wrap this conversation up, Jim. But before we go our separate ways, where can listeners of the show follow your work?
The only place to follow my work is on X/Twitter, whatever Elon's calling it these days. It's at Jim Jatris. That's the only place I really am active. I don't do any other social media. I haven't been writing that much anymore, although I do try to do more and more talks like this. And of course, you know, my book, as I mentioned, I tried to warn you. You know, it's easy to find Jatris. I tried to warn you. It comes up on the printer's Lulu, but you can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and elsewhere.
Great stuff, Jim. Thank you so much for coming on to the show. You're always a fountain of great geopolitical knowledge. And for the Barnes Review History Hour, this is Jose Nino signing out.